Good evening.
Good evening, Venerable Sir.
Good evening, Venerable Sir.
How's everybody?
Fine.
Good, thank you. How are you?
Oh, I'm really good.
Oh, good.
Actually.
That's good to hear.
Getting prepared here. All right. So, we are going to review what we've talked about. So, this was a class on proving future lives, which turned out to be actually sort of a class on the introduction to logic, Buddhist logic. And future lives is a good way to start that. If there are no future lives, it sort of means that it doesn't make a lot of difference what we do during this life. And therefore, there's no reason to study Buddhism if there aren't future lives. So we need to think about that. The proofs that we covered are, well, proofs in general are the basis of any logic system. And a logic system in some way describes in very precise ways one's experience of the world. And it allows one to know things that you cannot normally perceive. And this is true of the Western system of logic as well. If you studied logic in high school or college, you studied probably Aristotelian logic, and that's very similar to Buddhist logic. Westerners who have studied logic will have little trouble with Buddhist logic, even though the subject matter is different. It may be even very different, like past and future lives. You probably don't study past and future lives in logic classes in high school or university. And now in the monastery, logic and the theory of perception are studied together. We know our world through perception, you know, which is represented in links 3 through 6 of the Wheel of Life. And we examine what we perceive by means of logic. And usually the logic is pretty much like, I know what I see. But as we learn more about the Buddhist universe, you know, through the Abhidharma Kosha, we expand our knowledge to understand things in ways other than the way they might immediately appear to us. And then we use logic to begin to understand things that do not appear to us, but do indeed. So, perception is the starting point. You know, what is the Tibetan term for perception, or more importantly, accurate, valid perception? And we covered that. It's sema. In Sanskrit, the word is pramana. And this is one of the main things that you should retain from this course. Accurate, valid perception. What is an accurate, valid perception? Or a tsema in Tibetan, or pramana in Sanskrit. In the school that we've been using, which is the Sautrantika school, the second school, the second lowest school, pramana means correct perception. And later on, when we get to course 13, where we study logic in the Prasangika school, pramana means valid perception. And most of what we perceive are tsemas. We know what things are by means of tsemas, correct perceptions. No, tsemas are important because we should not be talking about things for which we do not have tsemas, meaning we should not be talking about things which we have not experienced or have experienced in a non-valid way. Now, Samas are linked directly to things in the universe. An existent is something that has been experienced or known by a pramana, or a tseva, or a valid perception. So for something to be an existent thing, it must be known by or experienced by a being with correct perception. And then moving on, Lord Buddha gave us the purpose of studying Buddhist logic. And he said, I or someone like me can judge a person, but no normal person should judge another, for he or she will fail. And the Tibetan word for fail is actually fall. And what he meant by that was you will fall into the hell realms in your next life. If you judge other people, you're probably at some point judging a bodhisattva or an emanation of a Buddha, and judging them incorrectly, and doing things that you shouldn't do in relation to them. And that will send you to the hell realms if it's done with strong motivation. And he gave an example of his own previous life for that. You know, so we have to develop ways of looking at things that give us pramanas regarding them. Lord Buddha framed the statement in relation to other people. You know, we only generate karma with relation to others, or mostly that's what we do. We don't generate karma with relation to trees or rocks or other things. You know, it's when in relation to people. So unless we can read other people's minds, we cannot know what they are thinking, meaning we cannot have a valid perception of their mind at a given moment. A Buddha does have such valid perception of everyone's minds, and maybe high-level bodhisattvas do too. But for us, you know, we don't have such a valid perception. Why? Because others' thoughts are not objects of our own senses. But we can develop such perception. A person just coming out of the first direct perception of emptiness can read others' minds, though maybe not every mind in the universe. And later on in the path of familiarization, we develop the ability to know others' minds, though maybe not all the minds all the time. So, normally, when we see a person do something bad, we think that his mind at that moment is a bad mind. This may be true, but it may also be false. That bad appearing deed may be a bodhisattva trying to teach somebody something. We just don't know. And that is why we cannot judge another person's states of minds. Now, do we not help somebody being beaten or robbed? Of course, we have to help them. But we do not judge either the person involved in the accident or incident. That is a pathway to bad rebirth for us if we judge them, if we judge their states of mind. Now, this all has to do with assumptions. Don't assume that what you perceive is true. Now, if you have a tsema as the result of an airtight logic, then you can judge another. But you have to do this airtight logic. Otherwise, you have to resist making assumptions about people, things, or events. Now, there are two kinds of perceptions, two kinds of tsemas. There are direct perceptions and there are indirect or deductive perceptions. Direct perceptions are those of our senses, and those we have such as a direct perception of emptiness. Indirect perceptions or deductive perceptions are the perceptions we have using our conceptual mind, which means anything we think about. Indirect perceptions are useful, you know. We use them all day long, and they get us through life. And these perceptions are always involve some type of logic. That is the process by which these perceptions are formed, but they are often incorrect, or at least incomplete. Direct perceptions are used to perceive evident or manifest objects, such as colors or shapes, tastes, smells, and so forth. Deductive valid perceptions are used to perceive hidden or deeply hidden objects. At a superficial level, we see someone acting in an angry way and immediately think that person is angry. We may be right, but that person may be a parent acting as a wrathful in a wrathful manner to teach her child a lesson. Such a person is not angry at all, meaning that the person is trying to remove some unpleasant object from their surroundings. That's what angry means. Something that is caused that is causing her physical pain or mental pain. Then, at a non-superficial level, we use deductive reasoning to understand emptiness, and we use it to understand emptiness at an intellectual level. We use logic to understand the nature of changing and unchanging phenomena. Changing things are perceived by our senses, but unchanging things are not. We use deductive reasoning in company with the teachings of Lord Buddha to begin to understand, or to have samas of, the laws of karma, for example. Things that are hidden to us are emptiness, for example, subtle impermanence, and the rough workings of karma. Our senses cannot perceive such things, but they do exist, meaning they are known by consciousnesses that can perceive them, which are high-level bodhisattvas and Buddhas. Spiritual things are hidden from us. The Sermon on the Mount describes hidden objects, namely that peaceful people will eventually have all they need, and so on. Now, our root text is by Master Dignaga, and it's the commentary on valid perception. His opening statement in that text has become famous in the monasteries. And that opening statement is, I bow down to the one who turned correct, who helps all beings, the teacher, the one who went to bliss, and our protector. These two lines explain the point of valid perception by describing one who always has valid perception, namely a Buddha. The terms in these two lines are code words, like who has turned correct. We didn't go through the code words, but will in the future course. For now, we just memorize the two lines. So what is a pramana, a tsema, a correct or valid perception? It is a fresh, unmistaken state of mind. Now, this definition is peculiar to, or it's unique to the lower schools. In fact, all schools accept the prasangikas. The pra of pramana is glossed as fresh or new by the lower schools. Thus, a fresh, unmistakable state of mind is the definition that they give for tsema. The Prasangika school, however, glosses pra as valid, which is one of the meanings of pra. We usually hear the term valid perception, and that is what is usually understood when a Tibetan hears tsema. But when the monks first study perception, they use the definition we have just given, a fresh perception. This is the definition you should use if you were asked to give one on one of your exams, like the final. Now, what are the characteristics of one who has valid perceptions, or a person of valid perception? This refers to somebody who always has valid perceptions, and that kind of person is a Buddha. One of the main characteristics of such a person, from our point of view, is that such a person will never lie. Everything he or she knows is valid, and following the principle that we should not talk about things of which we do not have a tsema, everything that person says is true. We could extend that to ourselves, to never talk about things for which we have no tsemas. Then everything we say would be true too. We would never tell a lie. But we probably don't follow that principle. A Buddha who knows all things correctly always speaks the truth. And it is one of those things, it's one of the tasks of logic training to convince ourselves that this is really true. So when we hear the teaching of a Buddha, we can have a realization of that teaching right there on the spot. That would be possible for us if we, through studying logic, could convince ourselves that everything a Buddha says is true. So simply by hearing them say something, we could have a realization. We would trust that. It would be more than information for us. It would be a realization. Now, this might not always occur for us, you know, but it could occur due to our deep understanding of this quality of a Buddha. We talked about the three main schools for a normal person to determine that Lord Buddha is totally correct about the very deep teachings he gave. These three methods are, first one, the teachings cannot be disproved by any valid perception that we have or have had. And the second method is the teachings cannot be disproved by any airtight reasoning. And the third one is the teachings themselves are free of any kind of internal inconsistency, meaning that nothing Lord Buddha said at one time contradicts what he said at another time. So these are ways, these are tests we can apply to what Lord Buddha teaches, or anybody teaches, to determine whether he's totally correct. Now, the last one, you know, the teachings themselves are free of any kind of internal inconsistency. It's interesting because on the surface, it appears that Lord Buddha did at times contradict himself. So we have to decide whether a particular teaching is meant figuratively or meant to be taken literally. And there are some ground rules about how we determine that. One ground rule is, what was the intent of the teaching? Lord Buddha must have had something else in mind when he said something that is, when he said something that is not really acceptable to us literally. Our question here is, what was Lord Buddha really trying to say? The second ground rule is contradiction. The statement that Lord Buddha made must contradict what we know to be actually true. And if that's true, then he must have been speaking figuratively. And the third condition, you know, we could call need. There must be a compelling need or purpose served by the Buddha saying something that is not technically true. Such statements by Lord Buddha are usually given for their shock value. You know, your mother and father are things to be killed. He said that. Whoa, you know, that's a major disconnect. What was Lord Buddha trying to get across? Good speakers use this technique when their audience is going to sleep. You know, you'll remember such statements and then try to figure them out. So if any of these conditions are true, then we should understand that the statement made by Lord Buddha was meant only figuratively. For example, Lord Buddha said, form is empty and emptiness is form. Now we can rephrase that as color is empty and emptiness is color. This statement has to be understood figuratively. color has no nature of its own, you know, and emptiness itself is a quality of color. That's what we would understand, you know. If we were to understand that emptiness is color, then we would have had a direct perception of emptiness zillions of eons ago, because every time we saw a color, we would be seeing emptiness directly, since colors are direct perceptions. But our experience is that this is not true. So that is an indication that we must look for an interpretation of what Lord Buddha was saying, rather than accepting the literal meaning of what he said. The parables in the New Testament, for example, are all to be taken figuratively. Now, Jesus even said, "Let those who have ears hear," meaning that people listening must interpret what he said, you know. He said, "I just told you something, you know, and you have to think about it. You must use educated, special ears." Now, even the statement, "let those who have ears," is to be taken figuratively. Of course people have ears, you know, and they hear. Anybody, almost, who has ears hear. So what did Jesus really mean, you know? And that would be something that somebody studying his teachings would have to try to figure out. So we're going to study how to determine whether statements by Lord Buddha are to be taken figurative or literally, and we're going to do that in Course 15. The different schools have different ways of deciding this. By the way, interpreting Lord Buddha's statements is an activity of the two higher schools, mind only and middle way. The lower two schools pretty much accept Lord Buddha's words at face value. The Prasangika school pretty much says that what is taught by way of the 3.5 lower schools is not literally true. These statements are to be taken figuratively. And the teachings that are that we are talking about are the teachings on emptiness, you know, but we'll get to that in Course 15. We have brought interpretation up in this course, Course 4, because there are teachings that contradict each other. Master Dharmakirti and Master Dignaga do not cover such things, you know. Interpretation is not part of the teachings on logic, but you do have to know that if you find contradictory teachings implying that one of those teachings is maybe a lie, you know, there really isn't a contradiction. We talked about what it is that a person has to know to be considered all-knowing. This is very simple. Such a person must perfectly know what it is that we must give up in both our behavior and our worldview. And such a person must know what things we must take up in our behavior and our worldview. This means that it is not enough to know the scientific names for every existing thing in the universe. That is not what omniscience or all-knowing refers to. All the things an all-knowing being must know are the things that will change a person's life, so that he or she can reach omniscience themselves. Lord Buddha taught the path as the way we leave samsara, and the path is the things we have to stop doing and the things we must start doing, along with our way of thinking about the universe or about existence. The teachings in the four truths of Aryas follow this pattern. The two things that are to be given up are the truth of suffering and the truth of cause. The two things to be taken up are the cessations and path, especially the path, which is how you attain cessations. How do we know Lord Buddha is unerring, not unmistaken? This goes back to the definition of tsema, a fresh, unmistaken state of mind. Basically, when we first encounter the four truths of Aryas, we first learn about suffering, and this teaching accords exactly with our own experience. And no one else has ever explained that to us in that way. This part of the teaching we can understand. We know that what Lord Buddha taught is absolutely correct. So we can extend that to the remaining three truths, which we cannot understand or accept through our own experience. We do not understand the sources of our suffering. Even if we understand suffering, we don't necessarily, and probably, you know, do not understand the sources of our suffering. We have no experience with cessations, you know, and we have not been introduced to the way of how we remove suffering in this life. In other words, the path, you know. So with regard to suffering, Lord Buddha taught three kinds. The suffering of pain we understand immediately, and other religious teachers have taught the same thing. The suffering of change we can understand too, presuming that it is taught correctly to us, you know. Other religious teachers don't deal with this so much. And then the third kind of suffering, the all-pervasive suffering, that our whole lives are steeped in suffering, you know, that is unique to Lord Buddha's teaching. But we can resonate with that too, based on our own experience. The understanding of this kind of suffering takes some logic and introspection, but it is something that we can understand fairly easily, fairly quickly. This third type of suffering is rather attractive to a thinking person, you know. It especially resonates with us as we get older and begin to experience the deterioration of our bodies. The Mahayana path involves great compassion. What is the difference between regular compassion and great compassion, or holy great compassion, you know? Regular compassion is the wish that others be freed from normal, common suffering, like being poor or having headaches, having cancer, and so forth. Most people possess this, you know. Parents certainly possess it in relation to their children. Hinayana practitioners possess this kind of compassion. This type of compassion does not involve taking personal responsibility to bring about the removal of suffering for others. Great compassion does involve this personal responsibility to bring about the elimination of all suffering for all other beings. It is a decision to protect all beings from suffering, all three kinds of suffering. Then holy great compassion is the compassion of an enlightened being. That is someone who actually does help all living beings. Great compassion and holy great compassion are really two divisions of great compassion. The first kind is that of the bodhisattva. They have taken upon themselves the task to remove all beings from suffering. But they can't really bring people to enlightenment, meaning removing all of their suffering, because they themselves are not enlightened. Then the second kind of great compassion is that possessed by Buddhas, those who have become enlightened and are bringing others to total enlightenment. Great compassion belongs to the Mahayana path, and holy great compassion belongs to the path of no more learning, the Mahayana version of no more learning. Now, when we get to class 6, which many of you have had, we begin to look at beliefs that Charvakas had with regard to future lives, examining Master Dignaga's refutation of their beliefs. The Charvakas gave three reasons why the mind died when the body died. First reason was the mind is a quality of the body in the way that the ability to make a person drunk is a quality of alcohol. The second reason they gave was the mind is by nature dependent on the body in the way that the design you put on a wall is dependent on that wall. And the third reason they gave is the mind is the result of the body in the way that light is the result of a lamp. Now, if it turns out that you should be asked to give these three reasons, be sure to give examples of each. Like The mind is a quality of the body. The example, in the way that the ability to make a person drunk is the quality of alcohol. Okay. Now, which of these three have we been brought up to believe? Probably all three. These three reasons are very similar or familiar to Western scientific thinking, or at least scientific teachings that we are exposed to in school. Note that only the last reason involves cause and effect. You turn on a lamp, and a very short time later, light reaches your eyeballs. The second reason is not cause and effect, because the picture on the wall, the picture and the wall occur simultaneously. They happen at the same time. And the first reason simply involves a quality of something. There is no cause and effect. The third reason the Charvakas does talk about cause and result. The mind is the result of the body. And this probably has to mean that the body is the material cause of the mind. So what is a material cause? A material cause is stuff, you know, physical stuff, that turns into its result. It flops over into the result. The material cause ceases to be when its result is produced. For an example, the acorn is the material cause of an oak tree. Its stuff, the stuff of the acorn, turns into an oak tree. And the seed, the acorn, ceases to be when the tree comes about. Another example, clay is the material cause of a pot. But when the pot is made and fired, the clay that made the pot ceases to exist in the form it had when it was formed into a pot by the potter. The fired clay can no longer be shaped into anything else. That clay has ceased to exist. Similarly, until the pot is fired, it cannot function as a pot, because if you put water into an unfired pot, the clay will dissolve and the water will run out, and there will be no pot. There are other things needed for a seed to turn into a plant, such as fertilizer, water, and sunlight. These are not material causes of the plant, because their stuff is not similar to the plant. They are not the main thing that made the plant. This discussion of mind and material cause was done in the context of where does the mind come from, and refuting beliefs of Charvakas regarding this. So why can't your mind at birth be living physical matter? The answer is shockingly simple. All living physical matter is involved with one or more of the sense powers. We talked about how there was a particular kind of living physical matter that made up your eye sense power, and that was the cells in the back of your eyeball. And there is also a particular living matter that makes up your ear sense power and your nose sense power, the taste sense power. Now, if we remove the living tissue of those four sense powers, what's left? The rest of your body. And that living tissue is your tactile sense power. So all living tissue is some kind of sense power. The Charvakas claim that this tissue is the material cause of your mind, as do some Westerners. But if this was true, then your memory, for example, would have to see things as clearly as your eyes, and hear things as clearly as your ears, and so forth. Our memories of things do not have the clarity of our sense powers. That is obvious to us if we think about it. Now, the refutation of the Charvaka's argument has two thrusts. Either all five sense powers are the material cause of the mind, or one or some combination of them are the cause. We just looked at the first thrust. Regarding the second thrust, If the person lacked an eye sense power or an ear sense power or both and so on, then that person couldn't have a mind. So, we have disproved the two possibilities of how the Charvakas say the mind is caused by the body. So, the mind cannot have come from living tissue. Now, we examine why the material cause of the mind can't be outside physical matter, like chemicals or the four elements. If some chemical element were the material cause of the mind, then there would have to be a mind whenever that chemical or element was present. And the creation of that mind would involve the destruction of the cause, namely the chemical or the element. Our experience tells us that this does not happen. Secondly, if some combination of chemicals or elements were the material cause of the mind, then a mind would have to form even when said combination of chemicals or elements were present. Likewise, our experience tells us that this is not true. Additionally, if the mind were the result of one or more of the chemicals or elements, then when one of the elements was removed, the mind would cease to exist. And further, the mind does not exhibit any of the qualities of physical matter. The mind is crystal clear. It is ineffable. It is aware. It has no physical boundaries. It cannot be weighed. It cannot be measured as a size and so on. The mind, in fact, is the complete opposite of physical matter. Okay, so mind's cause is not physical matter. If that is so, then it has to be a mind. Something that isn't physical matter has to be a mind. We could say that. And since we have no mind when we are conceived, then it has to be somebody else's mind. That is the cause, right? Well, one of the rules about causes and results is that the result must be similar to the cause. So if our mind at birth were caused by the result of other minds, namely those of our parents, then our minds would always resemble those of our parents. Children of musicians would always be musicians. Children of scientists would always be scientists. Children of criminals would always be criminals, and children of preachers would always be preachers, and then there would never be any Buddhist monks or nuns because monks and nuns never have children. And it is obvious to us that this is not the case at all. So basically, now we are left without any material cause for our mind at birth, and this cannot be the case. Because we do have a mind at birth. So where does it come from? Master Dharmakirti said that it must come from a similar cause, and since it doesn't come from some other mind, it must then come from a previous moment of our mind at birth. And that moment must have come from a previous moment of mind in the womb, and so on back to the moment of conception. And then that moment of mind itself must have come from a previous moment of our mind, and that moment had to be the mind of a previous life. Similarly, when we die, our mind continues on into the mind of our next life. So, then, if our mind crosses over into a mind of similar type when we die, how does this happen? And Master Dharmakirti says that while we are living in a desire realm body, we are having the emotions of liking things and disliking things. And we do that ignorantly, you know, meaning that we cling to them as self-existently capable of giving us happiness or causing us suffering. At the moment of death, we experience the emotion of desperately wanting our life. You know, as a human, for example, to continue. We don't want to be separated from that. And this emotion is extremely strong because we sense the body slipping away and we identify our mind with our body, you know, which is an ignorant thought. It is this strong emotion, ignorant desire, you know, that causes our mind to cross over into a new life. It is the condition that triggers the projecting karma we have gathered during the current life and past lives. So after all this, Master Dharmakirti states his proof for future lives. It is a logical statement, meaning that it has three parts, the subject, a predicate, and a reason. It goes, consider the mind of a normal person at the moment of death. That mind will cross the line into a future mind because that mind possesses desire. Now, we spent some time looking at karma and rebirths as represented in the Wheel of Life. The eighth link is called craving and means that we crave the feelings that are link number seven, you know. Link number nine is grasping and means that we grasp to these feelings once they occur. We grasp them as being self-existent, meaning that they do not come from us, but from the object, or rather that the object which we experience is capable of giving us these feelings, and we really want them to continue. Links 8 and 9 are desire in different intensities. The eighth link has three types. There's craving desire. Now, this is where we desire, in an ignorant way, not to lose an attractive object, which at the time of death turns out to be our life, you know, or maybe our body, or maybe our mind. This ignorant kind of desire means that we would hurt somebody to keep this object for ourselves. We understand that it is the object that is the source of our pleasure and not our own minds in the form of karma. That's what craving desire is. The ignorance is thinking that it comes from its own side and not us. The second type of the link is craving fear, which is where we want to get rid of an object causing unhappiness. This is ignorant desire too, because we understand that our unhappiness comes from the object itself rather than from our mind in the form of karma. Craving for existence is a third kind of the eighth link, third type, you know. We crave for existence, which is that we desperately want to continue the me in this life. We don't want to be separated from that me. We fear that we will go out of existence if the me is harmed or if it dies. This is very strong at the moment of death, because we have great fear that we are ending, that the me is ceasing to exist, and we don't want that to happen. So in all three of these cases, the desire that is operative is ignorant desire, meaning that we don't understand that whatever we are experiencing is the result of the way we have treated others in the past. Something is happening to us, and it has nothing to do with us. That's what we feel, you know, and so we are afraid. The Wheel of Life in these few links shows us how we move from one life to another. Craving, which is the eighth link, is very intense, and it produces the ninth link, which is grasping. And that results in the tenth link, which is existence or becoming. The eighth link triggers immature karma, which is link number two, and it makes it mature karma, which is link number 10. It does this by focusing on yourself. There are four levels of this craving. The first thing is you focus on yourself, the me, in a general way. We don't check or examine our true nature. this state of mind is itsema. It does not trigger immature karma. The second level of Link 10 is seeing yourself as self-existent, as having some nature of your own, that you come from your own side, and you believe what you see. This is a mistaken state of mind, and it does trigger immature karma. The third level is seeing yourself as self-existent, but you do not believe what you see because you have seen emptiness directly. A person with this outlook is a bodhisattva on grounds 1 through 7, or maybe even part of ground 7. When such a person dies, immature karma will still be triggered into a next life. And this is why you don't stop rebirths simply by reaching the path of seeing. And then the fourth level is neither seeing yourself as self-existent nor believing that you are self-existent. Such a person has overcome the inner or inborn tendency to see things as self-existent. Such a person is a bodhisattva on grounds 8 through 10. Such a person, at the time of death, does not trigger the immature karma that will result in a projected or forced rebirth. This doesn't mean that that kind of bodhisattva will not take another rebirth. What it means is that the bodhisattva will not be forced to take a rebirth due to his or her karma. In other words, links 8, 9, and 10 cease to operate for bodhisattvas on grounds 8 through 10. Now, here's a story. You may have heard this before, but here we go. Once upon a time, there was a Buddha who emanated on a planet in a galaxy far, far away. The Buddha remained there for 10 million years or so, and then decided to remove his emanation from the planet. Before doing so, he appointed one of his close followers, a monk, as regent, as the one who would carry on the teachings. This regent was very advanced and began teaching bodhicitta to people in cities. Now, a monastery must be located at least 500 fathoms away from a city. A fathom is an arm span, from middle finger to middle finger when you stick out your arms to both sides. Monks and town people are not supposed to mix. Monks do not go to the city except to visit sponsors, and then they must go in groups. But this regent went into the cities, and he taught, and people gained bodhicitta. There was another monk at a monastery who happened to be in the city when the regent was teaching there, and he saw the regent touch a woman, and he knew right away the regent was violating his ordination vows. And he began to tell other monks about that. Soon afterward, the regent, in order to prevent a schism in the monastery, said he would no longer travel to the city to teach, and he indeed stopped going to the city. People in the city stopped learning, and some stopped having bodhicitta, and things eventually fell apart. Sponsors stopped sponsoring monks, and so on. So the regent told the monks, "This isn't working out well. I will leave the monastery and move to the city and teach," which he did. Eventually, the monk who criticized the regent died and spent millions of years in the hell realms due to his incorrect assumption about the regent. And then he had millions of rebirths as animals, and then he had millions of rebirths as a stupid human. Now, this story is from one of the sutras. As Lord Buddha was telling the story, he said that the regent became a Buddha who preceded Lord Buddha by a million years or so. And then he said that the man who criticized the regent was me. That's what he said. And he goes on to say that the job of a Buddhist is not to criticize other people. It is to remove one's own mental afflictions and obstacles to omniscience. A person who stays in his room and works on his afflictions and meditates and cleans up his own mind. That's what our job is, basically. A person who does that is higher than all the bodhisattvas on such a planet who teach the 10 virtues. A person who does that will reach Buddhahood. So this is the scripture Master Dignaga quotes at the beginning of the compendium. The main job of a person striving to help others is to clean up their own mind, and one of the necessary tools to do this is logic. So that's sort of the highlights of Course 4, the Proof of Future Lives. And if you have questions, I will try to answer.
I have a question about the first level of the link number 10, existence becoming. I'm not able to grasp these, that it doesn't trigger immature karma if I have an unanalyzed perception of myself. I didn't get it. Which kind of perception is that? When I'm dying and I say, okay, now Brigitte is dying, I don't have a problem with it, bye-bye, then I don't trigger karma?
This first level where you focus on yourself, where you focus on me and you know about me, even if it's unexamined, that's a valid perception. Is there a self? Yes. Is there Brigitte? Yes. Is there a Venerable Phil? Yes. And so on. That's true. And that's the first level. Just that does not trigger the immature karma. It's where we begin to grasp to it as seeing that as self-existent, because it is. That's what triggers the immature karma.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The first one is a tema. Is there a self? Yeah. Does it cover its own side? No.
Mm-hmm.
I think it does.
Okay, thank you. I would have another one regarding the material cause or the definition of the material cause. I'm not sure if the material cause is referring mainly to physical stuff, which flops over in the result, or if it is more the main cause. Because I think when I speak of the mind, which is the material cause for my mind in the next moment, I think there is no physical stuff.
We normally talk about material causes, physical stuff, and the examples we give are physical things, so we can grasp it.
Mm-hmm.
But anything that any changing thing is a caused thing. It's a result. There must be a cause to produce the result. And the thing that flops over into the result is the material cause. Mind is a caused thing. So the material cause, even though we can't see it, for a mind is a previous moment of mind.
But it's not physical stuff.
It's not physical stuff.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Great. So you're all ready to take the final?
You have prepared us very well for the final. Thank you so much.
I have another question.
Okay.
So very often when we think something, we have a chemical reaction. I think always when we think something, we have a chemical reaction in our body. I think even when you see something, so it's connected, so is then the cause and effect of the mind and the body, is it in relation, or how can you explain this connection?
Very, very good. When our senses react to a stimulus, that will produce a chemical reaction or electrical or something like that. And in the living tissue that is our senses, I mean, that's what happens, our sense powers. And those trigger a perception by the sense consciousnesses. Now, it turns out that the perception by the sense consciousnesses is not material. It is mind. They are direct perceptions. So it is here where somehow or other things that are occurring in the body, in the living tissue, produce some sort of consciousness. How that happens, I haven't a clue. And as far as I know, it's not described in scripture anyplace.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay.
The reverse happens also. Something happens bad, and you generate fear, which is a mental thing. That will produce a reaction in your body, which is a physical thing as well. So it runs in both directions. We know that it happens. Why? Don't know. Or even without talking about fear, you know, when you want to say something, you think about what you want to say, and then your body does the thing which produces the sounds, which are physical reactions. So that's a really interesting thing to think about. Don't spend too much time on it. But
yeah. Yes, I think so.
You're like crazy. Well, as you won't go up about it.
Thanks, yeah.
Okay, well, that does it.